welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast about our gaming group. I'm your host, Tom Donnelly, and I am here with two of my favorite people in the world. First off, we have Jordan. Jordan, how you doing, sir?
Doing well. How are you, Tom?
I am very, very well. Good game with you yesterday, man.
Yes, we played a good game of El Grande. We'll talk about it later.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. And then I can't see him right now, but behind the huge iHeart Podcasting Award... Ben Madelker is back there somewhere. How you doing, Ben?
Hi, Tom. I'm over here. I'm over here.
Oh, there you go.
I'm waving. There I am.
Do you think we could move this somewhere? I mean, I know it's in the process of being bronzed.
I don't know. Like, it's really like a... Like, I need to make sure it's in front of me and showing off at all times. All okay, people.
Well, yeah. Yeah, I can see that you have a chain attached to it, so you can just wear it like Flava Flav.
Yeah, nice. I'm going to New York tomorrow, and I bought a seat for it.
Fantastic.
That's
exactly what we're looking for here.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Congratulations officially on the pod. Yeah.
Thank you.
Very, very happy for you and Ronnie. You guys are some of the hardest working men in show business, and it's paying off. You guys.
Thank you. You guys are giving me so much love. It's really... Actually, one thing I forgot to mention last week. This is not like a... I forgot to thank this person, but... the thing that I was actually most excited to share on the podcast last week about that whole experience that I forgot to was that I flew back from... South by Southwest, and I landed in LA, and I went directly to Matt's place for game night. And I have to say, like, there was something really lovely about having this major career achievement, like the highest career achievement I've received, or not achievement, but like recognition, right? Mm-hmm. Award. And then to just go immediately and plug into board games right after and with my board game pals. And everyone was just like very sweet to me. Like everyone's like, congratulations. And it was like a really nice way to cap off an exciting time for me.
So I'm now getting, I don't know exactly why, like, I know exactly why. The reason is that I'm doing estate planning now for myself and my wife and all that sort of stuff and things like that. And we're, you know, the wills and all that sort of stuff. And the moment you Google one of those things, you get a million ads and Google is just sending you, like all the articles coming up are all about... You're getting older. You're getting close to retirement and all this sort of stuff. And article after article that for some reason I keep clicking on because I'm like,
getting old.
Which only feeds the thing. No, but it's things like, it's like what nobody tells you about retirement, like, and things like that. And so I'm like, well, super clickbaity, but I can't stop myself. I have to know what do they not tell you? And the two things they're talking about are brain health and loneliness. Brain health and loneliness. And they keep talking about how for men in particular, but everybody right now, people do not have the tight knit group of social connections in the real world as opposed to virtually that they need to stave off loneliness and depression. And there's a lot of depression going on in retirees and people, you know, over the age of, you know, 60 or whatever. They're hitting a lot of that. And having a gaming group that are people that I genuinely enjoy hanging out with and seeing them once, twice, and sometimes even three times a week is so important. And then the brain health is also the thing that gaming is great for.
So every time you make a good joke, Tom, we'll say, it's because of us.
It's because of you.
Yeah. Exactly. We kept you sharp.
That's the way it is. No, it's something
that Jordan doesn't have to look forward to for many, many, many years because he's a wee baby.
He's just a little one.
He's a... You are millennial, right? Or are you Gen Z?
No, I think I'm a millennial.
What's before Gen Z? He's before Gen Z.
Is Zoomer before... No.
No, which Zoomer one is Gen Z.
Zoomer and Gen Z are the
millennial,
same.
Yeah, there is millennial then
there's
Gen
no before that. No, I'm even
younger. Oh, I see.
Nothing happens before...
You mean after that?
Yes. There you go.
Well, it depends.
Well, you are 31. Thomas. You're 31.
I'm 31.
So you're either an elder Gen Z...
I'm also working on my estate plan. Getting ready. Well,
you're an old soul.
You're a lawyer.
I'm joking.
No, you
he
should.
Has a mature voice. Like
I'm 100% serious. When I my wife and I, we did something when the kids were very young, and that's, you know, one of the times you do it, right? So we did it, and then I realized, oh, half of that is no longer valid. We need to change things up and do that. It's important.
It is important, and I really need to do it. It's been on my to-do list for like 9 months. And I keep putting it off, not because I'm scared to, but it's just the idea in life of having to make one more appointment and have one more consultation and figure something out. But, you know, it's important to do.
Well, I know some stuff about estate planning, so if either of you need help, yeah, absolutely.
That's you're doing estate and trust. I've started
practicing estate and trust law in the last few months. Yeah,
I've been the executor of my uncle's estate for some time now, and it's been a long process. If things are not buttoned up right, it really does create a situation for the people after you.
Does it? When you play the game Last Will, in an attempt to tie this into board games, do you feel like it is accurate to your experience?
Well, that is a Brewster's Millions game, so it's not really about estates or estate planning at all. It's just trying to give away all your money.
But you played the estates.
I do have a tie-in to a board game, but it's a little
attenuated. Actually, I have a tie-in too. Ours is the same.
What is it?
I was going to talk about how recently finally got some plays in of Legacies.
Excellent. You should do that. Mine was far more attenuated.
Wait, are you going to still talk about yours? Or?
No. Later.
Wait, I would like to know.
Let's do Legacies. Okay. I'll bring it up when it comes up.
The reason why I'm bringing up Legacies, Tom, I feel like I haven't actually talked with you about this game yet.
No.
Because you were under the weather for a few weeks. Glad to see that you're feeling better.
Much better, thank you.
Something that we talked about on this old podcast, and that I played two aborted games with Jordan, and then I played a third aborted game last week. Legacies, it's a game of generational wealth. And it's a game where you are.
I just want you to know, I'm not just a host of this podcast. I'm also a fan.
Well, for those who just became new fans over the past 4 days, it is a game of generational wealth, and you are basically the head of I guess it doesn't start as a wealthy family. It starts sort of as a wealthy family. I guess you start as a wealthy family, but you are generating wealth and then finding a successor and passing it on. And the game takes place over 6 generations. So we talked about this game on the podcast. I was really excited to play it. Got it at the flea market. So Jordan and I, first we played a 2-player game to kind of iron out the rules.
Right.
Which was, I'm really glad we did that.
Yes. I think the first 5 or 6-player game that we played would have been really rough.
A disaster.
Are the rules complex or ambiguous?
Tending towards ambiguous, in my opinion.
Yeah. The rule book needs another revision. Like, there are
so
just
many rule books are just surprisingly missing the thread, right?
Yeah. It's like, it makes you appreciate the good rule books. And it makes you really appreciate how they're actually, like, a lot of the games that we love have very, very well-written rule books, because that is a good rule book can actually, or a bad rule book could ruin a game.
100%. Because if you don't know, if the rule book doesn't direct you, not just how to play the game, but how to get to the meat of the game, you can just play around the edges and really
ruin your opinion. That's a great point.
I just always think of, like, when I started in the hobby a long, long time ago, the old Avalon Hill rule books were written by aerospace engineers, and section 1 subparagraph B, and it lays out this thing, and God bless them, they thought they were doing, they did the best that they could, but it is so antithetical to the way human beings learn things that they're literally writing it as instructions for the parts of an airplane.
They're writing it like a reference manual.
Yeah.
They want it to be something you can refer back to once you already know how to play.
Exactly. A lot of 18XX rules are like that. And it is useful when you know the system and you say, oh, wait, how does the train rust work in this game or something like that? And you know which section exactly to go to is helpful.
I want to hear more about Legacies, but as a quick detour, do you have a favorite rule book? I do. Does anybody else have a favorite rule book?
I can't say offhand.
Sure.
I can't say.
Dungeon Lords is...
You know what's so funny? I thought of that. It's not my favorite, but I thought of that one almost immediately when you said... Because it stuck out in my mind as a notable rule book.
It is funny as hell. It is written with love. And somebody went to town on that rule book and just said, this is it's one of those weird things where the first person in gets a half reward. The second person in gets a two-thirds reward. Third person gets the full reward. Fourth person gets back down to a half or a quarter reward. And they explain why that is. It's like, okay, so the first goblin goes there. and he sniffs out the fact that there's food there. The second one, it gets a whole bunch of, third one just gorges himself, but then there's nothing left for the fourth. And they describe it in such fun ways. It's also very functional, though. It reads, you're reading it like you're reading a story, and by the end of the story, right, you understand the game.
I actually struggled with that rule book.
Really?
Yeah, because I found that there were lots of little, like, humorous asides that were just there. I think it was there to break up the monotony of it all, like to break up the sense of like, oh my God, there's so much to take on. It was trying to kind of like lighten the situation and make it like digestible and fun. But I found it was very distracting.
Well, I feel the same way. I mean, humor in a rule book is a real risk, because if someone doesn't jive with your humor perfectly,
You didn't like it?
No.
Yeah.
And I feel like the same is true of like Galaxy Trucker. A lot of games made by Czech Games Edition have these humorous rule books. They don't really work for me.
Interesting.
But I like...
For me, the thing about Dungeon Lords is it's actually a surprisingly rule-dense, hard-to-understand
game. Yeah, it was a lot.
Traps work this way. Monsters work this way. The corridors and the rooms work this way. And then there's the whole mini game of the adventurers coming in and invading, and this happens before this happens, before this
Such
happens.
Such a hard game, by the way.
It's a very, very difficult game. I think the rulebook does an amazing job, because that is a bear of a teach.
Actually, for that, yes. And I think that's where a rulebook could, for me, ruin a game. More so even that, like, instead of, like, in addition to what you said, Jordan, about how you could, like, play on the fringes, a rulebook, if the rules are like not stated cleanly and like unambiguously, you find yourself going back to it multiple times. Like, how does that work? And what happens is the actual momentum of the play session starts to flag. And then, especially if you have people who don't have total buy-in on the game in the first place, you can see them start to go, okay, can you look that up? And you just can feel frustration. And so you really risk like the vibe at the table, like going downhill. And like, Jordan, I've talked a lot about how I can't stand games that have like lots of little rules. We have to check back. Like, well, what happened to this scenario when there's a barbarian over here, but there's a so-and-so here, but there's also a thing here. Wait, let's check how that works.
We used to call that Chrome. Right.
Yeah.
That
was you're right.
The term for that. Yeah.
And so that drives me nuts. So with Legacies, I think if Jordan and I had not done kind of like a trial run, that five player game would have been like, we would have lost all the buy-in. Like, no one, not only, it would never have come to the table again, I think. Because.
Well, or might have years later when people are like, oh, you know what? This isn't so bad. This is actually a pretty good game, which is the topic that we're going to be talking about this week.
Right.
That's beautiful.
Jordan recommended this topic. He said, let's talk about games that when we first play them, we're like, meh. And then over time, we come to develop that deeper appreciation for it, right?
Yeah. And part of that is from Ben and I went on a little journey to explore those types of games. But let's talk about Legacies for another minute, and then we can jump in.
Well, the rule book is, I think for anyone who's going to be playing it, just like, know this, the ambiguities are really rough. And because the game was not like a huge hit, there's not a huge amount of support on BGG, which is frustrating.
Right.
There's no FAQ, and it desperately needs an FAQ. The rule book has things like, it'll say in some areas, like, this is like a... It'll reference an area called the Hall of Successors, but then it doesn't actually say what the Hall of Successors is anywhere. And I have the PDF, so I searched Hall of Successors. Oh, it's like, it's one of these things, it's just very inconsistent. And also the layout. I think also it's not just about how a rule book is written, like how information is presented visually really impacts your ability to go back and find that rule. Like, how many times, Jordan, when we were playing in both games, where we're like, what happens if you fall off a track, then do you get something, do you not get something? And you would go through and look and like, it seems like it should be in this area, and we'd pass it back and forth, and then finally one of us would find it because it just was not visually where it should have been, like where it seemed intuitive to be, you know?
100%. Yeah, it was very strange. That rule in particular.
Yeah, somehow between like if your rules are presented like a block of text, or like maybe there's too many indents or whatever, it's such a strange science of how to make information digestible.
Because those Avalon Hill rule books are horrible to learn how to play a game or to teach a game, but they're great for that, right? It's like, oh, well, clearly we're going back to section 7, subparagraph D is exactly where it is.
Right.
It's laid out that way, like Jordan said.
But this that game, being said, though, yeah. the
Tell
game
us what you like about Legacies,
the game, I do like it. It was interesting. The third game got 4 rounds in, and I then came down with like horrific food poisoning, and I was so mad. I was like, I can't believe I'm never gonna be able to finish this game because I had to shoo everyone away. But the game is such an odd one. I like it, but it's an odd one because there's so many things going on. You are in everyone has a character, and then your characters are related to industries. Two industries each, and so you can invest in your own industries. You can invest in your other characters' industries, and as those industries flourish, you can get dividends. But also, every character has heirlooms. Like their family has precious heirlooms, and so you could buy other people's heirlooms, and then as their industries flourish, their heirlooms become more important. They generate fame for you, or maybe you just lock down your own heirlooms, and then your heirlooms generate money. Maybe you're giving like tours in your estate to show off your heirlooms. I don't know, but there's all these. And then most importantly, you make relationships with other characters, and the relationships generate resources and things. And there's all sorts of strange interconnected things that are happening.
Yeah. I'm dying to try it out. It's a very interesting game, right? Because you have these two dueling currencies. You have fame and you have money. And money you need for your actions. You also can donate it to your foundation, which will be worth fame at the end of the game.
And it's turn order.
Banking points.
Banking points, kind of, but at a far lower rate than you can just earn points for, you know, as you're going. And yeah, you have this dueling heirloom system, right? If you buy your own heirlooms, they'll generate you money. If you buy others, they'll generate you fame. But then tacked onto that, there are all these other strange little systems, like the stock investment system, the relationship system where you can become friends with somebody, and the successor system, which is kind of one of the centerpieces of the game. Every round is a generation, and you have a successor that is going to take over your family for the next generation that you have to play at some point during your generation.
Is it going to be Don Jr.? Is it going to be Eric?
I mean, a lot of them are like that.
That's exactly right. You said Paul came up with this framing of all of your successors are terrible.
Right. And I think that's, by the way, if you play this game, it's really important to look at it that way. Because if you look at it like, oh, the successor is going to give me a special power. Oh, my God. But like everyone got a good power except for me. Most of the successors are actually really bad. And the framing you should really adopt is like, you have this great generational wealth. And oh, my God, look at my crappy success, like my privileged, you know, spoiled son who's totally incapable of taking over the family business, you know?
Right. It's difficult because there you have a deck of maybe 50 or 60 successors, and there are probably 3 or 4 of them that are really good for you. And the other ones are terrible. And you get to draw usually like two. And pick
two. One. You don't get a lot of choice. Exactly. There's not a lot of flexibility.
Did you get Colin Hanks or did you get Chet Hanks?
Yeah, no, that is literally what the game is like. And I think it's that framing is important because if you don't have that framing, you could get really annoyed by the flop. But if you have that thematic framing, you can find it to be very funny, actually. Like, actually, when we played, Jordan, I was a socialite, and my daughter was named Cecilia, and her defining trait was that she was ignorant.
It's good that they have that naming. All the successors have one word to describe them, and most of them are not flattering words.
Ignorant successor. Right.
Paris.
I think I was like not allowed to make relationships or something like that, like I was like out of the social circle. So it's like thematically, it's a very funny game.
When Paris Hilton hosted Saturday Night Live, some of the cast members noticed that she was genuinely uninterested in anything or anyone except for her. And they made a bet that one of them couldn't get her to ask them a personal question about themselves. And they were allowed to strike up whatever conversations they wanted, all to just get her to ask one question about somebody other than herself. And they lost that bet horribly.
Oh, I 100% believe that.
That's really funny.
That is very funny. Yeah. So that is, I mean,
that's the character.
This game does afford like role playing like that, and you can create your stories. But yeah, like there's a lot of weird systems that, it's not that the systems are weird, it's just that the way that they all intermesh is weird. And the gameplay is very interesting because it's card play, but also kind of like Puerto Rico style quote unquote global events that you can play, wherein you say, I'm going to trigger that event, which means we all get to do the same thing, but the person who triggers it gets a better version of it.
Sure.
And, but you're not allowed to start triggering events until everyone has played two rounds of card play. So there, and the thing is, the cards actually are often more useful than the events. And there's a weird timing. The round ends when a certain number of events have been triggered. So you want to get your cards in, but then someone may end the round. But then you also want to, you do want to do the events.
Sure.
So there's definitely an interesting way of actually doing your turns and sequencing.
Yeah. One way to think about it is the card play is extending your own board position. And the events are more like scoring that position, usually.
Great point.
Right? And so you want to extend your board position before it scores. But if you're the one who triggers it, you get a little bonus scoring or a little bonus money that'll help you out. And so that's like one of the primary
tensions. You guys played this at what player count so far?
Two player, which would not recommend. No. I mean, it was like we had to play with a bot. Which we actually started to forget about the bot, which was
Well, we were still struggling with all the systems.
Yeah, you're trying to follow the last thing we wanted.
We were like, oh, we forgot the bot had to take a turn. And then the other two were actually at five players. And
plays to six, right?
It plays to six. Five. You know, I have to say, I did not mind five players. I thought there was like a lot of good table talk. Mm-hmm. And there's definitely a lot of interaction, which is good.
And playtime?
This is a long one. Like
5 hours?
The four generations, we started around six at around 7:30, and we're done with generation four by midnight.
And that's two-thirds of a game.
And we did have
6 hours probably.
And like with a 30-minute break for early. It's not necessarily it feels like it could, if you have a group that likes this game and plays it a lot, you could probably make it a game night game. Because I think in the beginning, there's a lot of like, what am I doing and why am I doing it? Like the game does not have a clarity of purpose. And so you are just sort of doing things. But I think one would come through.
Is it something that in the teach you could impart that? Or is it something that is it something that evolves naturally over the course of the game?
That's why I'd want to play a full game, because then I could really know where it's headed.
Well, I'm in.
Okay, because I really want to play like a full game. It's an interesting game, and I think it's a game where it reminds me of Brass, where if you try to just do your own thing, you will probably end up with failure. But if you are reading the game state and seeing what other people are doing and figuring out ways that you can capitalize off that, you will find success. Like I had like a power. I was like, this is a good power. I'm going to flog it, and I'm going to do this so I can get cheap heirlooms. But then when the power went away because I got a new successor, I was behind everyone else, and because I hadn't been actually reacting to what anyone else had been doing, where everyone else had been.
I think that's a good point in comparison to Brass, but I also think that if you're a fan of Brass, that does not necessarily mean you'll be a fan of
No.
A correlation in that way. It's a correlation in the way that going your own route is a detriment, generally,
right.
Which is true.
Right.
You have to engage in the...
Brass is a far significantly better game, let's be honest. Brass is Brass.
I was going to say it's tighter and it's shorter.
I mean,
it's
if focused, not fair. You can't compare it.
What are the elements that Tom looks for in a game? What are the things that Tom is going to like in a game? I think most people would say things like he wants player versus player interaction,
yeah,
all that sort of stuff. But my number one by far is, can I LARP it? And it sounds like I can LARP the hell out of this game.
Actually, that's to me the best part of it, because not only do you have characters, not only do you have successors who have names, and the successors have personalities, but every card you play has a title. So it might be something like the very first card I played on Saturday was a brilliant idea. And so I played this card called A Brilliant Idea. And then I went and made a relationship with the local inventor, who was played by Shay of Rado. And then afterwards, Shay went and he then made a relationship with the local thief. And then they all flourished, and I had no money, and they were all making so much money. And I was like, oh, well, I had a brilliant idea. Mm-hmm. I told the inventor, and he went, and he stole it, and he did it with someone else. And here I am, this like retired general who was just languishing, and I've got a daughter. But then it turns out that the daughter was actually the promoter's daughter or something. Like, we created a whole story.
I feel like I just have to, I have to play it, and I have to bring back my hegemony middle class voice.
Which is what? Like, it was sort of like a Ted Kennedy?
Oh, my God.
Oh, no, that.
Oh, no.
It was still bad. Don't know how that's...
Oh, no.
Still don't know how that's, right. That's middle reaction. Class.
It's not quite middle class, but it's...
You
it's,
could
a, de- it's a wonderful voice, and it sounds like, for Legacy, it's going to be like, I don't understand how Daddy did it.
Yeah. You will have many chances to do if many voices. If I remember correctly,
that was your middle class voice, but it was... Your impression of a middle class person trying to imitate yes. a
right.
capitalist.
Yeah, it was like
trying to be the capitalist.
Right. Socially.
Exactly right. Trying to put on airs, right?
Yeah. So, anyway, that was Legacies. It's fun. I want to keep exploring it, but it's a weird one. Like, it's not like.
It's a very strange game. It's more outside the realm of what you'd expect than most of the games we play.
So, yeah.
Definitely look into it before buying, I would say. Like, take a. I don't know. Are there any videos?
There are well, there was actually a Rado video, and Heavy Cardboard did a playthrough, and there was something else. Yeah, check those out. You'll see, it's a real funky one.
Last night we had a 10 person group, and when you have a 10 person group, you're going to do 10 person Avalon, and when you do 10 person Avalon, it's always an interesting game. I think the higher player counts for Avalon are very, very interesting, and you know, not to talk too much about it, I thought it was a really interesting game.
It was fun.
It was the bad guys won the first two missions. The good guys won the last three missions.
Well,
half an hour discussion happened. Yes, that is
I messed up. So I was a bad guy, and Trey was a fellow bad guy. And for some reason, my brain said Trey was a good guy, and it was someone else was the bad. Like that, I saw Trey. I saw Trey's. We made eye contact and everything when we had to. But like, you know, 45 minutes later, I don't know. I just had a brain fart.
So you voted no on the
I voted team no on a team that like would have gone. And
but somebody else did too. Another bad guy.
Yeah, Paul
on
did.
On the team. But he said it's because he thought it was a trap. He thought it was
to out him as
everyone's going to vote no on this and we're going to see who the bad guys are. So
I think that's not
quite a broken game. You know what I mean?
No, it wasn't. It was just but I messed up in that I made a move based off of information that I had literally like.
And yeah,
messed up in my brain.
After a scant hour and a half conversation, you guys won the game because you figured out who Merlin was.
Yeah. Well, I was not part of that conversation. I abdicated myself because I was like, I've already messed up enough for this team, so I'm just going to stay out of it.
But it was Nick. Nick played a very good game as Merlin.
He did great.
He did a really good job.
I was shocked when they found him. I was like,
oh, I was shocked too. Man. I thought for sure it was Dimitri. I was so confident. But I was like, you know what? I'm not going to mess up twice. And they had a whole, like Trey and Paul had like a very, and then James had a very big discussion about who, and I honestly was not listening.
They were deeply methodical. They went point by point through.
I couldn't follow.
The pros and cons of this person versus this person. It as much as I complain about how long it took, and it took a long time. They did come to the right deduction. The great thing about Avalon, we'll stop talking about it now. But the great thing about Avalon is that during the main part of the game, all of the good guys, the blue characters, you're detectives and you are doing an investigation, trying to piece together the puzzle and figure out who is telling the truth and who is lying. When the game ends, if the good guys win, the bad guys then get to do the investigation. And yeah. They get to do the exact same process in reverse, try to figure out who's the one who knew too much.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, it's kind of a double dose of deduction. And I love that about it.
Yeah.
It was a very well played, very good game.
Yeah. Except by me.
Well,
I did terribly.
I thought you did.
I was terrible. I was such an obvious bad guy from the start, and I messed up my own team. I just was.
And let me ask you a quick question. Did you put your thumb down when we said Merlin, put your thumb up?
I did.
Okay, then you did great.
Okay, I did.
We have a new bar.
Okay, great. Great. Yeah. But yeah, then you guys played El Grande over there, right? Huh?
We did. I'm always eager to play El Grande. I mentioned it. And then Jordan, sitting directly on my left, is like, I've never played El Grande. I would love to play El Grande. I was like, boom, done, in. Well, we had a new player. We had somebody that had never played the modern... board games, our hobby.
Yeah.
So you always want to figure out what's the gateway game? What are we going to get you in with? And for me, it's like, it's got to be elegant. The rule system has to be simple. It's got to be fun. And it's got to show you the potential of these new games.
Demacher. And then everyone's like, no, Tom, no.
It's a little much. But a game like El Grande is very easy to understand, and yet the implications of all of the design decisions are fairly profound. What do you think, Jordan? Because you've been
Yeah, it's an interesting game. I really liked it. It was my first time playing it, as you said. It's a very old style game. It's very simple. It's just area control. You're putting your guys in there, but it gets to the point very quickly and, you know, concisely. It's an auction by playing these cards yep. for the ability to put cubes on the board and the ability to manipulate the board with these other abilities.
And to get cubes that you can put on the board.
And to get cubes that you can put on the board, right? And I don't know. I think it's really fun. It's delightful. I think it would be like a 5 or 6 minute rules explanation. And you could just start playing. And there's a lot there to explore.
Yeah. And it's an area control game. And a classic area control game is very player versus player. Very, Jordan is 10 points ahead. We have to come together.
Yeah. And stop take a bar to his knees.
The minute the scoreboard would adjust, Tom would be like 2 points behind and say, "You guys, I'm losing so badly. Take pity on me, please, please." And then he'd be 2 points behind the leader, and he'd be like, "The leader, Jason, he's so far in front.
Oh my god,
we need to take him down.
Why isn't anyone stopping him? It's a runaway leader situation.
He's coming.
It's
classic to
Tom.
Pais Basque.
He did win."
Let me tell you something.
He did win. I warned you, and nobody listened.
When we do our review of Cusco, we're going to be talking about that.
Oh, hey, no, okay. Very similar thing. Where those slightly older games are based on the premise that the games will be self-balancing when you see who's ahead,
mm-hmm.
right?
Because there is not score compression, but there is definitely plenty of opportunities for bash a leader.
Yeah.
Especially in this game, especially in El Grande, because so many of the special actions you get to take are, hey, remove four people's things on the board, move four people's to different places. So you are literally messing with the very carefully constructed majorities and minorities on the board in very interesting ways, and you can really attack people in that sense.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it looked like you guys were having fun down there on that end of the table.
It was a good game. It's always a blast. I mean, you played Hansa first, and Hansa borrows a lot from that game.
Did you feel that?
In a lot of ways.
There is a system in both Hansa and El Grande where you have to make your cubes available for their use on the board. So that is the same across those systems.
Yes. I would argue that the laying out of your merchants along the road and an action being taking people's merchants off and putting yours on in their place, there are corollaries to it. It's different, but it's all part and parcel of the same system. It just ends up coming to less an area majority and more a score this route. So in many ways, it is scoring. It's just micro-scoring as opposed to building up toward the big scores.
Right. I think Hansa has this extra added element of investment where you're putting a cube on a route that you know someone else wants to score, knowing that they'll have to bump you and you'll get an extra benefit from that.
Correct, yes.
And right. So that added twist adds a lot of depth and grist to the game.
I think Hansa is a great game, and it stands
one of the best of all time,
El Grande, for sure.
Sure,
but I love them both.
Both great games.
You know, I'm glad you brought that game Hansa up, because I feel like
we should say Hansa Teutonica.
Hansa Teutonica is Hansa. Yeah, you're right. Hansa Teutonica, great game. I think it's a collection essential, and everyone should have it.
Agreed.
It's just one of the. I think like Hansa Teutonica and Concordia should be like in literally every person's collection.
It's actually on the list of games that I want to talk about games that I wasn't quite so enamored with and only grew to love over the year. We'll talk about that.
Okay. And same with the next one. Last night that we played, I won't get too much. I'll talk about our session a little bit, but Franchise, we played another game of Franchise on the other end of the table. And that also reminds me of Hansa Teutonica because... by the way, I'm just going to say Hansa going forward. That's okay. Yeah, we're not talking about the other Hansa. I'm like, now I'm paranoid. I'm like, what if someone gets confused right now? You know what I think Hansa Teutonica has, and there's a certain genre of these games where there's a relatively static map, but like it's an incredibly dynamic experience because it's all about, like you said, players self-policing and making sure that the game state is what, I don't know, this parody in the game state or whatever, or like, everyone has to pay attention to everyone else. Yes. Right.
It is your job to police runaway leaders.
And Franchise, which we've talked about a lot, and I'm going to be talking about later in this episode, really is about that. You know, it's like we're sprawling out on a map and people are trying to take control over regions, and you kind of have to tussle with people. Otherwise they have free reign. And so we had a really fun session, like a really, really fun session last night with Paul, James, Dimitri, David Gillison, and me. And it was good. But Dimitri was just like, he played a strategy I've never seen before, which was the arm's length strategy, which is that he was only concerned about expanding into areas that he could reach with his arm.
so physical proximity to the physical board.
Physical proximity, which meant
the anecdote that you told was hilarious. Of you asked Dimitri at the end of the game, why said, did you go into
Florida? So what he started off his franchise. You can start anywhere, and there was one area of the board, like California and Arizona and New Mexico, were two different regions that were both hot, like the highest points in the game. And David Gillison started there. And then Paul started in the high money area. So I went to go contest Paul to make sure he didn't have a monopoly over there.
And naturally someone needs to
And James was sort of in the middle of the country, so he was gonna sort of be like, he was gonna take care of everyone a little bit. So naturally someone has to come and go after Gillison. And Dimitri decided to start in Florida, which, because of the layout of this map last night, Florida had low value cities and a low scoring region. Like, there was just no reason to start there. So at the end of the game, after Gillison had won, because he had free reign of this great area, I was like,
because he played very, very
well. And he played very well. He actually did play well. He did. He did some.
Why are you doing that, Jordan?
I don't want to hurt. I don't want to hurt David's feelings.
David, he doesn't have feelings. Okay. Do you not know this?
He did do some really smart things. Like, he did some really aggressive moves to lock people out of his region. But, I was like, so Dimitri, why did you start in Florida of all places? It was so low scoring. Like, why was that attractive to you? And he goes, well, and he starts like as if he's about to launch into like, there's something about Florida with the sun. And Paul goes, it's because it's what he could reach. And he goes, yeah.
Paul cutting straight to the point is hilarious.
It drives me a little crazy.
Sure.
Yeah. Oh, it made me actually, it actually really, it made me, it was very funny when he said that, and sure, I laughed, but in retrospect, I was like, so you weren't really there to play the game. You were there to move stuff around in your corner of the board.
You kind of break the game if you're not, like,
I mean, it wasn't totally broken. I mean, James lost by five points. It was very, very close. It was still a huge amount of fun, and there's still a huge amount of laughter, but it's also like, I was like, Dimitri.
Yeah, but right. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's tough. That's tough.
Yeah. He was like, tonight I just want to play in my corner, which, by the way, we all have those moments. We're like, I don't know. I just want to have my little corner of the game, and I just want to play in this little corner.
Don't touch my stuff.
Jordan, don't touch my stuff.
I've never seen Jordan have that moment.
That's true. I usually get involved.
That's right. Yeah. Jordan's a mix it up kind of guy.
Yeah.
Jordan is I drink your milkshake kind of guy.
If I can, I will drink your milkshake.
Jordan is so sweet, but he will cut you.
No, yeah. You both share that, by the way.
That's what
you both
not,
you present you wow. present very you,
Ben does not think of himself that way.
No, but he doesn't.
I'm an innocent, delicate lady.
You present adorable and then the teeth come out. You guys are both that way. I present as a shark, but I'm really
I'm a very sweet person. I would never do anything aggressive. Did I play a game in the afternoon yesterday where I spent the entire game pillaging Jordan's victory points? Perhaps. But I'm just a gentle soul.
You were just playing the card. You were just doing.
I was just doing what I had to do.
Thing if you can get people. Yeah. People look at me as a danger and a threat, and you guys are the nice guys. But
so maybe we can talk about that game. That could be the first in our topic of games we're revisiting.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Was there anything? No, I have no other.
So the topic today are games that started off kind of meh, or started off that we weren't that interested in, and over time we came to love, we came to deeply appreciate, which is something that happens from time to time. I mean, we talk all the time about the opposite, where, oh, I loved Messina the first three or four plays, and then by the time we got to the sixth or seventh play, I don't know if I need to play it again, right? The bloom off the rose is something that just, that happens in a lot of things, but it can happen very much in this hobby. But sometimes there are those games that just kind of get under your skin, and what started off as something where you thought, I don't need to play this more than one more time, suddenly becomes a lifelong love, right?
Yeah, like you revisit it, like you say, you play it like once or twice, like this is fine, it's not great, and then it sort of sits on your shelf, and then you're like, well, I got to clear off the things on my shelf. Let me give this one more play to know for sure if I really want to sell it. And then you play it and you're like, wait a second.
Yeah.
Wait, what? Like, how was I not playing this every day for the past 5 years?
Exactly. Exactly.
So
Jordan, you were the one who brought up the topic. What's the first game that comes to your mind within this area?
Well, I'll be honest. I had a slightly different framing of the topic.
Oh, by all means, please.
It was games that we initially wrote off that deserve a second chance, but not necessarily that have already become a lifelong love.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So it could be on the spectrum.
Might be that.
Right.
That made a much better impression the second time around or something like that.
Or that you revisited a few years down the road and found to be something that you initially wrote off and shouldn't have, that you should have given a little more time to.
Right.
So, oh, okay.
So right, still in the sorry. Same
we
kind
that,
of...
We can do that too.
I just don't have any games that I love that I recently came back into contact with that I'm sure will be lifelong loves. That's a very,
well, it's see, all kind of on the other same.
Way. I don't really have any games that I am rediscovering that I think might be. I think I've kind of made my conclusion.
I think that's fine. It's just you're just farther along down the path. But it's either way. In both cases, these are games that initially were kind of like maybe meh or whatever, and then second time around just sort of looked at it the second time around and said, wait a second, there could actually be something here.
Yeah. Right. I mean, for me, like I can start by saying some of Reiner Knizia's games, especially some of his early games, they're so simple that when I played them the first few times, I was like, oh, it's a great game. I'm not sure it's really for me, right? I'm not sure that it's not something I'm going to keep coming back to, but I liked it. I thought it was great, right? Yeah. I very much enjoyed it, but it's almost a little dismissive of it in the back of my mind because it's so simple. Like, Jordan, do you remember playing Ra a few weeks ago?
Yep.
Yeah. Ra is one of those games. Samurai is one of those games. Modern Art, even. I looked at my rating for Modern Art this morning.
Yeah.
I had it down at a 7.5. I immediately changed it to a 9.
Yeah. Modern Art. Raw is one of my favorite games.
Oh, my God. It's an amazing game. But
yeah, I don't love Raw.
It's kind of...
But maybe, maybe in 2 years.
It's such a nothing burger on one in one aspect. But every time I play it, it's like the Grinch. My heart grows another size.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And every time I play it, I'm just more and more realizing, oh no, there is something just so beautifully elegant and so difficult.
And so, Ra is one of those games that you can introduce to anybody, and I have, to a variety of gamers and non-gamers and pseudo-gamers, and everyone, after one play, everyone I've played it has said to me, where can I buy this?
Except
and then
for
I have to tell them. Except for Ben. And then I have to tell them...
You can't.
And then I have to tell them, you cannot. You can buy it for $300 on eBay until another printing
or
comes out.
Or you can take this copy for $500.
Mm. Right. No, I wouldn't even sell mine.
But I mean, obviously, I see the value in Raw. I don't love set collection. So, like, the auctions in pursuit of set collection, like, it's more like... I don't dislike it. It's just more like he has other really fun auction games that I prefer more.
But it's not a game of set collection. It's a game of greed.
Yes.
That's really what it is.
And the auction system is
I'm
really
not a greedy person. I'm a good person.
You can only win 3 bids, right? How greedy can you get with those 3 bids?
Yeah.
And
I won the last game we played, I won with having the worst sons, the worst bidding tokens ever.
Mm.
But all I had to do was keep having these auctions go off when there's only a few things out there and force people to use their higher numbers for lower rewards. And
that is very clever.
And so many people, their highest bid markers never get used.
Right. Because you think it's worth so much.
Right.
So you're like, I can't waste this 13 or 16 on this, piddly set of tiles.
It is a game of greed. The psychology behind it is very fascinating, as you guys talk about. I'm like, that is really cool.
Modern Art 7.5. How the hell did I put it?
That is shocking.
It is a deeply LARPable game. I put on a thick German art collector accent
as you should. Play. Like,
love it. Absolutely adore it.
I'm shocked that it was so low.
Another, Tom, you should try the next game that I'm going to segue into, which is the Imperium system designed by David Turtsey. It is highly LARPable because there are 30 different civilizations you can play as, and I'm sure you have an accent for each.
I could.
Have a Hungarian accent? Because I played as the Magyars yesterday.
Ooh. And I was the Japanese.
We'll just imagine.
Anymore.
I've been told I'm not allowed to do that voice anymore. No. In all seriousness, we reviewed Let's Go to Japan last week. Yep. I was playing the other game while they were playing Let's Go to Japan, and Ben had to stop me during the rules teach and say, Tom, you need to stop doing the Japanese accent. I can't focus. I can't do anything.
I was like, I know you're not, I was like, you need to stop. I was like, I can't hear the rules.
I love Japan. I spent time in Japan.
I know you were coming from a place of learning
Japanese, so I'm way into it. But yeah, it can sound very wrong.
you were coming from a place of love, but I was like, no, I can't.
I understand completely, and I stopped immediately.
And I appreciated that.
Not at all.
So anyway, tell us about this game that could provide different ways for Imperium. Tom to do accents.
Right. So this is Imperium. I think the original sets, there were two sets that came out in the midst of the pandemic, 2020, 2021, called Imperium Classics and Imperium Legends. And they each had 8 civilizations in them. And now in February, a new box came out with 14 more. So there's 30 that you can collect. And it's a deck building game where you'll play as a single civilization with a unique deck of about 30 cards that will let you do, certain actions that are very asymmetric. The way these civs are built is one of the most interesting parts of the game. So I'll cover that more in detail in a moment. But you play, to one of various endgame conditions where you're building up your empire from a state of barbarism to a more civilized state, collecting various cards, which might represent trade deals or lands that you've conquered or, new technology that you've developed or processes that you've undertaken or important religious ceremonies or icons in your history and also important leaders. And you sort of do that over the course of the game. And then at the end, you evaluate the position of your civilizations. So I initially played this game during the pandemic. I bought it. It's a good solo game. And I was like, it's the pandemic. I have no online friends. Let me buy a solo game for myself. And I didn't connect with it. I played one or two games of it, just didn't connect with it. And part of it is because I don't like complex solo games, which is something I've learned about myself. If I'm going to play a solo game, I want it to be done in 15 minutes or 30 max. And this one would probably take 2 hours. Right.
So you're not going to play the Hunters. You're not going to do a World War II submarine campaign against yourself.
No, I don't think so.
Or Mr. President or whatever it's called.
This game came back to my attention this week, actually. So, my friend Brandon brought it to me. And we played a two-player game, and I thought it was really fun. The interaction was really interesting, and what drew me in was the way the civs functioned differently, the asymmetric aspect of the civs. And then Ben and I played another game yesterday.
Yeah, we had a two-player game, and I had a very fun time. It's like, and it's not necessarily my cup of tea in the sense that I wouldn't go out and buy it. But
not a huge deck builder guy, really. Is one of the things for it.
Right? Okay. Yeah, I like deck building, but it was, to me it didn't feel like a Civ game, and that was, Jordan and I talked about this extensively, about the things that we look for something to feel like a Civ game, and we've actually talked about that on the podcast before, and the things that I like to feel, that make it feel like a Civ game, I didn't feel like were present in it, but as a deck builder, I thought it was like, it's very fun, and it was cycling through my deck, and I got all the thrills of seeing that card I like come out again. And I was really mean to Jordan the entire game.
There's a very interesting system in the game.
I was a barbarian
called Unrest, right? You were a barbarian.
Actually, we both were barbarians, but I was really more barbarian in culture.
You started as a barbarian, and the Magyars, the way their civ functions is, when they eventually converted to Christianity, they lost a lot of their power and a lot of their influence. And so Ben was trying to prolong his period of barbarism and, avoid you know, converting to Christianity throughout the entire game, you know, in order to prevent himself from having to suffer those negative consequences. And he managed to do it for almost the entire game.
Well, actually, no, I didn't. So I, what was clever about the game was that that wrinkle of it really did not become apparent to me till all of a sudden I realized, oh, I'm on the verge of becoming Christian and I'm going to lose all my powers. And I was like, oh no, I have to stall out now. And that was thematically very fun, as like playing as this group that was like resisting this conversion and wanting to hold on to the old ways, because that's all my cards. Like every card that had a barbarian symbol on it would then become totally useless. So that was, it was fun. Like I had a really fun time, and it was like, you know, it was so interesting for me being such a, I think a good, nice person to play this role where I was pillaging Jordan every single turn.
Right.
Yeah. It was so strange to you.
It was strange and alien. It was nice to step into that world for once. Sure. Yeah.
Right. Of course. Right.
And so I played as the Japanese, and starting off, I had two dueling religions in my people. We had Shintoism and we had Buddhism, and only one of them could be in play at any given time. So I played a Shintoism card. The Buddhism card would have to be discarded. And you really wanted to have both powers in play because they were complementary. Mm. And once I formed an empire, I was able to establish a temple that allowed me to integrate those two religions.
Right.
Which I assume is historically what happened. And then bring people into those religions. So it's really interesting the way that, you know, these simple cards model these complex civilizations and give you a little taste of the history. And that is what is so appealing to me. I want to play all 30 of the civs, including, you know, legendary civs like the Arthurians and the Martians and other sorts of groups, and see how the
classic
game models
Martians versus the Magyars,
these different groups. And there's also more obscure peoples like, you know, the Taino, and I can't think of another example right now, but you know, you get the picture.
Right.
I think I'm going to sell you one more time on one piece of it, Tom, that I think you'll like. There are cards that are in your deck that are leaders. And these leaders are, they do something different with leaders. Like if you're playing a traditional Civ game and you have Gandhi, you have this little ability for the whole game, as if Gandhi's living for, you know, the 1,000 years that you're developing your Civ for. In this game, you play your leader. It's a one-time big effect, and then it goes into your history, which is an area of cards that you never interact with again during the game. So it's like they came in, they had their effect, and you remember them. But they're not really part of your Civ moving forward, and I like the way it models that. So I'm excited to explore further.
I'm sold. I want to play.
It was cool how it did model things like that. But at the end of the day, though, I did feel like I was just playing cards, and it was not. I didn't feel like I was building a civilization. But that was fun, and I'm glad that you found like a second one with that.
Yeah,
I like obviously I've been talking about franchise. Has been a big second wind game for me. Maybe we should call it like that, second wind
game. Second wind game, I like that.
But like franchise was one that was on the chopping block for me. I played it once when I bought it in 2018, and then it sat on my shelf. I had a very nice time when I played it, but it sat on my shelf for years, and I was thinking about getting rid of it, and I pulled it out recently, and something about either the gamer that I am now or the gamers I played with this time versus the gamers I played with last time, but like the whole game came alive in such a vibrant way. And now it's like, it's 100% staying in my collection. And, you know, I really like that it plays five players. So for last night when we had to break into five player games, that was a good option. And it's good for new players because it's got really simple rules, but, players with more experience can find a lot of like meat on the bones. Like there were a lot of really big decisions and choices. And by the way, you know, I gave Dimitri shit just now, but at the same time, like one of the fun parts of those games is that when someone is playing in a way that you don't expect, like it's kind of fun to see how everyone else has to like deal with that. And like, what does that mean? How does that change the board state? Cause you know, it just creates a whole new dynamic. So it's a great game. Franchise is unfortunate it's out of print, but I think there are copies that are around if people can get it. It's just, I think it's accessible to everyone. I'm excited for, I think both of you guys have not played it yet, right?
I have not played it.
I think that you guys both, especially you, Tom, I think you would really, really like it quite a bit.
I'm in.
So franchise is one of the big ones recently where I revisited and was like, oh, this is a good one. This is a keeper.
I think for me, the one that I would put in this category of games that might be go from meh to great is something we mentioned on the podcast recently. Dune Imperium.
It's having a moment.
I was going to talk about this too. That's great.
There we go. Dune Imperium, I did not love. And people are gaga over it. And I was just like, I don't understand what they're seeing. I don't think that this is a great game. I don't think it's a bad game.
Yeah.
It's not ringing the bell at all. It's competently put together, but it's not. But Uprising, everything I'm hearing about Uprising sounds like it could be the expansion that transforms the game. Mm-hmm. And there have been games that have been utterly transformed by the expansion. For me, I can name two. So Tribune, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
Initial Tribune. Listen, I bought it because it was Karl-Heinz Schmiel. It was the guy who created D-Mocker. He's got a Roman game out. He's my boy. I gotta go support the boy. I play it and I'm like, I like it, but I don't love it.
Yeah.
And then I hear there's an expansion coming out and people are losing their minds over it. I get the expansion and immediately I'm like, oh, this is a totally different game. Not just the fact that there's this asynchronous player that plays a radically different game than everybody else, but everything that was good about the game is suddenly dialed in and just he took a wrench to all these different things that just felt a little looser than they needed to be and made this tight machine.
We should be clear, Dune Imperium Uprising is not an expansion. It is actually just a fresh version of the game.
Oh, sure. Really? I did not realize that.
It's like almost like a second edition.
Yes.
So this is almost like Viticulture in Tuscany, sure. Where Tuscany was like, oh, let's fix.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Tuscany is correct. The other thing is, I would say that for me, you know, Grand Austria Hotel was my also ran in the Simone Luciani series. I didn't like it as much as Lorenzo. Clearly, I didn't like it as much as, but a lot of those other games, it was just sort of the also ran. But Let's Waltz really makes it a very different game. I mean, it is just a radically deeper, heavier. It is a bear of a game to wrap your head around and play. And really, it is 100% just an expansion, but it makes the game so different in so many different ways that I feel like I'm playing a whole new board game, and it's amazing now. It's one of my favorite games. It may be my favorite of his.
So in terms of Dune Uprising, yes. Dune Imperium Uprising, so this is like a new edition. People are losing their minds for it. I'm like you, Tom. I only played Dune Imperium once, and I had like famously like one of the worst experiences with it, just because we were supposed to play Bus. And then at the last minute, like it was like one of those things like, oh, I can either play this game or I could play Bus. I was like, I'm going to play Bus. I never played Bus. And we sat down to play Bus and no one knew how to teach it. So then someone was like,
oh, you know what? I can teach.
Someone was like, I can teach Dune Imperium. It's like, okay.
Who was it though, Tom?
I mean, and, you can tell that it was Elder.
And the point is that the person who taught Dune Imperium did not know how to teach it and didn't seem to know all the rules.
No, well.
And we sat there. This is an example. By the way, this actually ties in like the importance of like knowing rules, because totally. We sat there and was like, well, how does this do? What does this do? And then some of the cards were marked up with pen. And so
I think you should go back to Uprising, because I played Uprising this week.
Yeah.
My friends invited me to play and I said, you know, I think I might just stay home, because that's how little I like Dune Imperium.
Yeah.
And I decided to go, and I went and played. And you can actually catch this game on YouTube. It's on Optimal Play. My friend streamed it. Anyway, it was really fun.
Uprising?
It was very different from the original Dune in two key ways.
Dune Imperium.
The original Dune Imperium. The cards are far more interesting. In Dune Imperium, you get a card.
That was one of my problems.
Who cares about this card? Right, yep. Exactly.
Yep.
The cards in this game were... they made each player's position feel radically different.
That's great.
And they were very powerful and interesting. When you went to the market, you know, you had a really important choice about how you want to develop your deck. So it's more of a deck builder. The original game didn't feel that way. The other way it changes the game is, you'll remember the battle system wherein you get points for winning battles.
Yeah.
In the original Dune, it's like 1 point per battle for all the rounds of the game, up to 10 rounds. In this game, it's 0 points for the first 4 or 5 battles. And then 1 to 2 points for the later battles, or If you have a worm in that battle, you can double it. So there's this crescendo at the end of the game where you can score 4 points in a single battle, and it creates these big moments where someone's putting all their troops forward and someone's trying to defend for their life. And you know, you have these really big moments as opposed to the original game, which kind of plotted along.
Yeah.
You'd win a battle, you'd get some points, or you wouldn't, and then you'd go home and do it again.
So the Uprising feels more like Dune, the board game, where you're throwing everything, just desperately trying to win this one battle. That's perfect. That's exactly what it should be.
Yeah. I would totally be interested in playing it, because I also do feel like, you know, I really do deserve to give just even base game Dune Imperium like a proper shot, you know. And
I don't think you need to.
I wouldn't bother. I would just go right.
I'm going to insert myself into the Uprising.
There you go.
I'm going to do it. That's what I will do.
The other thing that's interesting is they try and make it compatible with the old game. So the new game only has leaders from Dune Part 2. You'll play as a character. I don't think you can even play as Paul Atreides, because he's in Dune Part 1. You can only play as, like, you know.
In Dune Uprising, you can't play as Paul?
I don't know.
He's the main character in Dune Part 2. He's the main character in Dune Part 2, to be clear.
No, I know. But I mean, like, it's only new characters. So, like, you can play as, you know, Fade Rautha, and you can play as Lady Fenring, and you can play as Princess Irulan, right? The characters who are in Part 2 of the movie.
Basically introduced
Right, exactly. I don't know if they have any of the old characters. You can bring them in from your copy of Dune Imperium, but apparently it might be a little wonky to bring in the original material, so that's
a little
funky.
Like a mess.
I'm not sure if Paul's in it. I could be wrong.
That's all right. I don't like Paul anyway.
Okay.
Well, Paul Atreides.
You're not...
If you're reading Dune correctly, you're not supposed to...
He's so mean to his mom.
It's... Well, it's what is the thing? The old saying is education is knowing that Frankenstein isn't the monster.
Right.
Wisdom is knowing Frankenstein is the monster.
Oh, look at that. That's a good one.
Is that good?
That makes you think.
Isn't that good?
Jordan's thinking. Hold on. He's processing.
Processing that. We should talk more about that after the podcast. That's an interesting.
It means that education means knowing that, no, the monster is just called the monster.
And Frankenstein.
Frankenstein is the doctor, not the monster. I see. But wisdom is knowing, no.
The
doctor is the monster of the piece. Right.
I thought you were talking about. Anyway.
No. Okay.
Frankenberry. You know
what I'm saying? I get what you're saying.
Okay, good.
It's a great quote.
Good.
Jordan, what's another game that you... Yeah.
Paul Atreides is the monster.
Dune Imperium was going to be my second one around. Okay, I'm going to talk for a second
about Netrunner. Oh, I stole something from Jordan. It's the best.
The thing about Netrunner is that I never didn't like it, but I haven't played it in 2 or 3 years, and it's come back to the fore, and so it's kind of a second wind. Actually, for me, it's kind of a third wind game, because I've played it twice before in my gaming history. It is... the best card game, in my opinion,
100%
ever made.
It is ever made. It is
like Card Battler. You mean
Card Battler?
1000% agreement. It is the thinking man's. It is the connoisseur's game. It is asymmetric in a beautiful, amazing way in which none of these games are. There is essentially an attacker and a defender of sorts and yet. The defender has plenty of attacks to their own style of play. Playing corp decks versus playing runner decks are radically different. The strategies employed in them are so different. Right. It's amazing.
We should start by saying the theme, right? It's a cyberpunk theme. One side will play as a corporation and one side will play as a hacker or a runner who's trying to, you know, to access the corporation's servers.
And steal your secrets, essentially.
And that's where the most amazing decision made, well, there's two, but one of them is all the points are in the corpse deck, right? The runner doesn't have any points in their deck and they have to go into the corpse decks and their hand and their cards on the table to try and find them. And the corp has to try and protect them. It's a genius design.
Yeah.
And secondly, the click system, right? Where you have 4 clicks per turn, basically.
Essentially actions.
And so you can set up these little combos, but not too much of a combo, right?
You're limited, right?
And like the way the design works is just fabulous.
This is the game that I played with my son for his whole teenage years, all of his teenage years.
We would just
bring it out and we would play it every single weekend, pretty much nonstop. It's just an amazing, amazing design, amazing game. And, Yeah, I absolutely agree with everything Jordan said.
If there's someone who's never played it and they play against someone who is very experienced in it, will the person who never played it have a good time?
Yes, if the person they're playing against is a nice person.
Okay.
And there are little handicaps that can be done. Every corporation has a different makeup and agenda and way of and style of play. Every runner has a style of play as well. Some are seen to be generally stronger or weaker than others. Now, it is a collectible card game, trading card game. So to some degree, you may not have the best cards for this player type and things like that.
It's not a collectible card game. It's an LCG. So if you buy a pack, you get all the cards. There's no randomness.
You can have up to three of each card type, and you would have to buy multiple sets to get.
That's not true anymore. No.
Is that? Oh, you're talking about the new version?
No, even in the old version.
No,
just the core set is what you're talking about. In the very first original core set, they might have only sold you one of a certain card.
Yes,
but every pack since then has had three copies of everything, and anything you buy right now would have three copies of everything.
Yes, I'm thinking of the News Corp dude, the kind of almost OP card,
Jackson Howard.
Yes,
he's rotated. Don't worry.
He's
you
out.
Can get all the cards.
Jackson
you
don't Howard have to buy
everything twice. In the old school, you had to shell out to make sure that you got three Jackson Howards in your deck so that you could
really
so that you could play that.
That was back. That was true in like 2012 though, right? Like.
What did I just say? I just said I'm an old school Netrunner player.
To be like, oh, I don't want to try this game because Tom said I have to buy multiple packs. You don't.
I'm just saying I did have to.
Yes,
Tom.
Okay, don't gaslight me.
We're removing the bandage over Tom's like Netrunner trauma.
So we should say Netrunner right now is FFG held the game for like 8-9 years. They made the game and they made this terrible decision with the core set, which they make with a lot of their games, which is a shame. But they canceled the game, and it was taken up by a nonprofit fan collective called Null Signal, who are making their own cards and doing a very, very good job. And you can go to their website, Null Signal Games, and you can buy all of their all of the cards they have made. And pretty soon, only cards made by Null Signal will be legal to play in the system.
So, yeah, they're transferring out the old system for the new system, right? And by the summer, they should all be replaced.
Fall of this year, yeah. So they've made 4 years worth of cards, and their cards are excellent. And what's really nice about this is they do, I think, two releases a year, and they're each like $40. So it's a lot cheaper getting into Netrunner than it is getting into Star Wars Unlimited or even like Arkham Horror or something like that. So,
wow, that's very cool. Are we talking about ready for some second winding?
Here we go.
Okay.
This is probably going to get a reaction from Tom.
Parcheesi.
Rummy Cub.
How do you pronounce that? Do you think it's Rummy Cub?
I would say Rummy Cube.
I think it's Rummy Cube, even though there is no E at the end of it.
Yeah.
But I don't know.
I don't know.
My mother is playing Rummy Cube right now, at this very moment. She said that because my kids are back from college for spring break, and I said, we'll probably call you today. She said, I'm playing Rummy Cube from 1 to 4 p.m.
That's the life. That's the life.
That's literally what she said.
That's great.
And I was like, oh my God, that's adorable. I will call you between 1 and 4. She said, no, please don't. I said, I will. And then you're going to have to look my kids on FaceTime and tell them that this game is more important than they are.
Yep. And she will, I bet. Rummy Cube.
Hey, Joan Donnelly don't mess around, okay? She'll make it happen.
So the big second win game, Jordan knows, I think, what I'm going to say because I played it with him. Black Angel.
No.
Okay, let me.
How many more times do I need to play it before its latent genius starts to show up? Because it's
not. I'm not.
Ben and I have differing opinions on this.
Well, and by the way, mine is not like oh my God, this is the best game ever.
Right.
But we played it about a year ago.
Yeah.
Actually, we've been meaning to have this episode since then.
Right. But there were a bunch of games that we like played.
We did like a doubleheader. We played Boon Lake and Black Angel.
Right. Two games that are widely disliked, I think.
Well, no, Boon Lake has, I think, has fans.
I will grant you this. I will grant you that in this category, a lot of the games that you're met on that later you find love for can be a result of expectations being so sky high for a game. And certainly Black Angel is about as high as you can. It's like, oh my God, Twa is one of our favorite games of all time. He's come out with a new design. Here we go. And then you don't love it. Right. And you can, that's a game that can be downvoted in your heart way harder than it deserves to be. I get that.
Yes. Right. I remember I played Black Angel several times and I was fine. It was fine, but like it was just overstuffed, never quite did what it needed to do. But we pulled it out. We played like a random two-player game.
Yeah.
We messed up a critical rule. I forgot what it was, but we messed it up. And
it was the number of dice the bot has or something.
Right. I don't think we gave the bot dice, and so we sort of like burned through the game quickly.
Oh, that's
right. But the reason why it's a second win game was playing it the second time, just sort of disconnected from the hype and disconnected from all the expectations, just playing it as a game. It was actually really fun.
I agree. It was a fun game.
It was a fun game.
Surprisingly fun game.
It was fun. It was breezy. I really liked it. And yeah. If push came to shove, it probably would leave my collection.
Right.
But it reminded me that like there is still actually a lot of stuff in there to explore and a lot of things to play with, and I would like to play it more. It's fun. I think it's more fun than its reputation now signifies.
Yeah, I agree. I think it also might be a little better at two than it is at larger counts because
maybe
there's this whole thing of cards. You put these cards on this sort of cascading planet board, and when they or space board, and when they fall off the end, this might be too specific. They're gone. Mm-hmm. And so you have to like put them out there and then activate them. And if there are too many players, the, you know, space might move too quickly before you get to activate certain cards.
Yeah.
And that might have made it less fun at a higher player count. Cause we were usually able to at least get one activation on our card or not. And you know, that was more fun.
Yeah. I don't remember how the game scales for larger players. Is the space board larger
just add one?
Just one.
Like maybe one in a three-player game, maybe one more space piece in a four-player game, but that doesn't feel like enough.
But it was very fun. It was fun, you know, deciding what to do, how to link things together, your special powers. Obviously, it's nowhere near Twa, which no. I would love to. I would love to play some more Twa. I put it on my challenge, my 2024 challenge for games, which is instead of doing a 10x10 this year, I'm doing a 10x5, 10 games, play five at a time.
I've had this conversation with you. I told you what you should do.
4x4, right?
A 2x2 challenge.
No,
once you've mastered that, once you're able to do, like, complete one resolution,
and I'm then almost at a 2x2.
What?
Well, I'm at a 2x2.
I've definitely done more than a 2x2 this year already.
I'm almost at...
Yeah, but you have to choose what the 2x2 is going to be before you do it, and then do it, which is... You can't just, in retrospect, say, oh, I played these two games two times each.
I would have picked the two games then.
Of course, I'm just joking about it, but nonetheless, 4x4 is like, surprisingly not the easiest thing in the world to get done.
But I'm making much better progress this year than I did last year with my 10x10, I have to say. Anyway, Trois on there.
It is March.
But
everything looks hopeful in March.
The point is this. Black Angel, you know what? Like, I think it deserves some credit because there's a lot of fun stuff going on there. And like, is it as good as Twa? No. Is it fair to compare it? You know, maybe initially with marketing, yes, but at this point, I think let it live on its own and have fun with it. I think these days you could probably find it like super cheap, so I think for a super cheap price it's a good deal. Are there games I want to play before it? Yes. It's like I'm not racing to get it to the table, but I think I included here because it was nice to have a revised opinion on it that wasn't so like sad.
Yeah
that's good. I got one. It's not really in this category per se, but it is one of those things. So Jason, the person who had never played these modern board games that came over last night, it was a big hit for him. He had a great time. It's awesome to introduce new people to the hobby. He came back into the big game room and looked around at all the stuff, and his eye was drawn to A Feast for Odin. And he was like, "Well, what's that game like?" And I said, "You know what? It's surprisingly good. It's been a super long time since I've played Feast for Odin." Yeah. It was one of those games that when it first came out, the polyomino aspect to it, where you're getting all these little doodads and they're in different shapes and you're filling up your little board, it really rubbed me the wrong way a little bit. Mm-hmm. And I recognize the design of the game is good. It's Uwe. I mean, how are you going to complain about Uwe too much? But it was one of those games where I was really hoping for a masterpiece. People were raving about it. And then I played it and I was like, it doesn't quite push my buttons for the play style. Right? A little bit. Yeah. Yeah. Now the expansion helps with that. It makes it tighter.
Expansion.
It is. It's a very good expansion. And I think that just because of the initial plays of it, I think I haven't ever gone fully back to it and given it its due and given it its chance. But I believe that it is one of those games that is an actual classic, especially with the expansion and everything that's changed. I think it's an amazing game and deserves a lot more plays. And the fact that Jason came in and said, "Hey, what about this?" I'm like, dude, you just pick the next game that we're gonna play next time. Now you come.
May I piggyback on that really quickly?
By all means.
My version of that is Fields of Arl, where the first time I played Fields, I bought it. I read such great things about it. I bought it, and the first time I played it, I was like, it's fine, but it's so loose. Like, I'm compared to Agricola, where you're like clawing for every single thing. It's so intense. And I was like, Fields of Arl, you can kind of just do anything you want. And I was like, this is nice. I kind of have some regrets about buying it. Now it's probably my favorite Rosenberg game.
Wow, that's great. And have you played the expansion?
Mm-hmm.
The T expansion is,
I think, Fields of Arl is like, it is, you can do everything you want. And like, the game is in editing yourself. And you don't realize that at first you just think it's wide open, so where's the game here? But when I revisited it later, I was like, oh, this game is so good.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want, but you have 28 actions or whatever.
Yeah. And like, everyone else is doing whatever your opponent is doing whatever they want, so can you do whatever you want better than they do whatever they want?
And it's a loved game, but for us, which is why the Feast for Odin, the reason I'm bringing it up and saying it's kind of sort of, because it was a very popular game when it came out. Yeah. It was just, for me, and actually for a lot of us in our play group, we were not quite as enamored with it. I think Maddie was, but I think several of us were like, it's good, but it's just not great. And now I'm coming back around to the time that I need to get that.
Candace had a real sort of renaissance with Feast for Odin too recently.
Yeah, and Candace is also a self-described, I don't want to say disliker, but she doesn't love Uwe games.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the one that's sticks out to her too. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it makes sense to end with a discussion of a few Pfister games.
I was going
to
say, because I have actually several Pfister games on here. I have literally, wait, there's one non-Pfister I do want to mention. Can I do that before we do our Pfister, Pfister finale?
Sure.
This is another one with Jordan. Jordan and I have really gone through a lot of these games, but Gold West, it was a game was originally released by TMG. I think it just got a whole new fancified version that came out in the past year. Gold West is a game that I got. It had like a decent amount of hype when it came out as this really cool 1-hour game. And I remember playing it. I was like, I like this game. It's nice, but like, it feels like there's no there. It just sort of feels like you do things for 12 actions and then it's over. Mm-hmm. And I had played it like maybe 4 or 5 times. I was like, yeah, it's nice. And then it just sat on my shelf. And I was like, I'll probably get rid of this one day. And I was almost going to get rid of it. Then I heard it was out of print. And I thought, no, it's out of print. I got to hold on to it. And then I was like, no, I still should probably get rid of it. And then we played it about 9 months ago, a year ago, right? And it was so much fun. It like came alive. I wonder so much with these games. Really, like, is it me changing as a player, or is it like being, now that I found Game Brain and players who play in sort of a different style, like, does it really help these games come alive? Because Gold West was was a really, really solid one. It is a 1 hour game and it was really solid with really chunky decisions. I remember having a really fun time. We played you, Candace, and Paul, right, yeah, Jordan?
That's right. It was a fun game.
Yeah.
And I think you hit on something important, which is, you know, all these games, we give them one or two tries and we're done. Mm-hmm. And the circumstances you played in, the people you played with,
sure, the mood, the vibe, you know, yeah,
and then you can just pan a game forever.
Things can slip by that way, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Fister finale.
Okay.
Here we go.
So we've played.
Please stop calling it that.
The Fister Fiesta.
Fister Fiesta.
That is not better.
Okay. We have played Boone Lake, Great Western Trail Argentina, and Sky Mines.
Yes.
I think all of which are games that initially didn't hit super well with the group, mm-hmm, that we've revisited and like more upon reflection.
Yes.
So should we start with, I know you're most excited, I think, about Boone Lake. Is that right, Ben?
I'm not, it's more like that was probably the biggest turnaround.
Sure. Yeah.
Which is that I had played actually two-player games with Jordan, which was very fun, very lovely. And then recently I played a four-player game with Candace, Paul, and Tim.
Did you play it when it originally came out? Did you?
No, I missed the window. Oh, and then okay. And then we had like a two-player game together. All right. And I remember in both of our two-player games, I felt like Boone Lake was nice. I enjoyed it. And it seemed like all the building blocks were there for it to be a game I would absolutely love, but it was missing an X factor.
So my first plays of Boone Lake were at PAX Unplugged in Philadelphia before it came out. It was like in the early game preview area.
Yeah.
And it was the game I was most excited to play, one of them. And we went and sat down and we got the TH. It was me and two of my friends and then some guy who just basically camped on the Boone Lake spot and taught it to anyone who wanted to play because he just wanted to play a lot of Boone Lake. And it was a miserable experience. It was like a 4-hour game. So long. And we were all so disappointed. And so I didn't buy it. And I was done with Boone Lake. And then you said, no.
I was like, no one's played it with me.
We got to play Boone Lake. We got to do it. And we played some 2-player games. And more than any other game, like you said, the biggest turnaround for me on Boone Lake because it was fun.
Yeah.
Still not my favorite Fister, but it was
fun. But the second game we played, 2-player, did incorporate the new expansion, which I think is called Artifacts. Mm-hmm. And then the 4-player game I played also used Artifacts. Artifacts is a really good expansion and I think should just always be included if you have it. It's really easy to add in, doesn't add a lot of overhead, and it lubricates it along, you know? But the 4-player game really felt like it came alive for me. Like I felt like all the things I was really hoping for, I think just a table interaction of everyone building out terrains and things just happening. It just felt like as much fun as we had with a 2-player game, and just 4-player, it came alive. And it was a long game, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. So that was a really great turnaround for me. And then let's talk about Great Western Trail Argentina.
Yeah, so we played that this week.
Yeah.
And last week, excuse me. And Great Western Trail Argentina. Yeah, randomly, very randomly. But it's a game that I think it's like everyone's least favorite Great Western Trail.
It's Jan Brady.
It is not my least favorite.
Oh, your least favorite is?
Okay, so I believe that at the end of the day, I am not going to love playing New Zealand much more.
And, you know, I think I'm falling into a similar boat, but maybe for different reasons. I think you think there's an imbalance, right?
I think that by having the sheep score two different ways, you are overpowering certain character types and disempowering others. I think builder strategy is crippled a little bit in that game. I've tried to make it work and I haven't. Now, I haven't played it 100 times, so I can't say that definitively, but I do think that while shearing as an added mechanic is really interesting, it does allow you to double up on your sheep game in ways that disincentivizes you from other modes of play to some degree. I also think that the wayfinder track is just kind of the superfluous added thing. I think a lot of the bonus cards that are added in are just kind of superfluous. It's a bunch of little things that aren't worth the overhead to me.
That second complaint really resonates with me. It's a lot of cruft, and it loosens the game in a way that it doesn't need to be loosened.
Yeah.
And it just adds a lot of stuff that, you don't really need.
I actually like that. I mean, the Wayfarer track, I think that the track is fine. It's just that it's presented in such an unimaginative way. I think, like, it's just, that's an example where, like, you know, moving your train down the track is also a track as well, but it just feels like more
there
fun.
There are decisions on that track. You know, oh, do I go into the station? Do I not go into the
And there's
the
some
station?
Decisions on the Wayfarer track, but I think that, like, I really like New Zealand. But the point is,
I love Argentina is what I want to say. I really enjoyed playing that early on. I think the decisions in terms of where your boats are going and how to get your discs off of the key and onto the high value spaces in the various cities is very interesting and very difficult. You have a new resource that you have to manage, and it's very difficult to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think it's great. I still think that Rails of the North, original with Rails of the North, is my favorite iteration of the game, but Argentina's close.
Well, go ahead. Yeah, I was gonna say. Well, we played Argentina, and it had actually always been my least favorite. Mm-hmm. I always felt like, you have the foundation of Great Western Trail, which is great, but I found like a lot of the new systems were not like they didn't mesh well for me. I felt like they were kind of convoluted, and it's like these boats go here, but these boats leave at this time. And this boat goes here, and then you can take it to this. You could drop your stuff off on this part or this part of the board or that part of the board, and then you have to move it down to this. It felt very sweaty for what it was trying to do, and it was not intuitive to me. And so I thought it was fine, but I just didn't. I missed the clarity of the original one. And then when New Zealand came around, I enjoyed the stuff that you guys may have an issue with, which I enjoyed actually, that it leaned more into deck building, etc. But we played Argentina sort of very randomly last week, and like, oh my goodness, it was so fun.
It was like
all those convoluted systems, they finally like settled in place. Yeah. And like when you're not dealing with those systems, you're just playing. It was magnificent.
Yeah, I think those systems really add a lot of interesting decision space. And for me, the systems in New Zealand, I'm realizing, don't add enough decision space that I'm interested in exploring. And the way the boats function and how you're trying to race to get your discs on boats before they leave, or falling short of that and having to plan much for the future, along with the system of managing this you know, very difficult to obtain resource and grain, is it adds a lot of meat to the bone that isn't there, I think, in either of the other two.
I also think he is the only game that you can speak with an outrageous accent. It is a...
I can't tell if you're doing Spanish. Accent? I can't tell if that's Spanish, French, or Japanese.
Argentinian. It's actually perhaps Uruguayan.
It's pan Latin.
You won't go say Uruguayan. Perhaps he is most closely to. It's very good. It's very different than most of the other. You are clearly going Italian. It is incorrect.
Top of the morning Italian. what I was going to say though was it was really fun, but I also I had a lot of fun playing a different strategy than I ever had in those games. I don't know if you remember, Jordan. Every one of these games has that starter building that's like you get something for every building that you built on, like trees. I had one that I had, you know, in Argentina, it's like you get grain for every building you build on, like on a wheat field.
Which, by the way, is way more powerful than in the other games. It's like two coins. I mean, two coins is impactful.
So I built all these buildings.
No, getting a grain engine is so important and so crucial and so difficult to manage.
Well, I mean, difficult in the wrong hands, Tom. Because what I did was I basically...
Claro.
I did the craft... I did the craftsman strategy, right? So I was... building, so I rarely get to even do that strategy. So I was doing that, and then I was building all these buildings, and I made sure every single one of them was on a wheat field. And so every round, I would be like, brrr, I would just get all this grain and
you'd like fill up to max. You'd get
all I was doing grain and I was doing certificates. I only bought one cow.
Bobel Constructor is what you are.
What?
Podemos hacerlo? Sí, podemos.
But I only bought one cow, I think, the entire game. And I got other cows as like rewards for things because of by delivering out in like outside of Argentina.
Right. We played with the backside of the delivery.
Which I'll also, I think, is really
money. Yeah.
I think that's really, that was really great.
Yeah.
And I mean, I didn't win, but I think, but I was extremely competitive. Like
very,
it was,
very close.
But it felt like it was one of those games where you're like, well, I didn't win, but I had so much fun on my journey that I like, who cares?
Yeah. You know?
Yeah. And it was cool to be that competitive without having purchased.
I will play any of those games, to be 100% honest with you. When I'm slagging, when it sounds like I'm slagging off New Zealand, I am not. It is still a great game. I'm just, my estimation of it over time has come down just a little bit from where it went from my newest, freshest breath of fresh air, mm-hmm. most fun, unique, different change in the game has slowly evolved into, that has not lasted the test of time so much.
And that's good to say, because I remember when that one came out, everyone was saying, oh, this is the best, mm-hmm. you know, Great Western Trail. This is the key version. And even saying, oh, they put Argentina first because they wanted you to buy that and then buy this one because it's the best. Mm. And everyone, even they knew it was the best. That was like a
well, there was narrative. There's a podcast called Game Brain. And when they did the review, they did say that they weren't sure whether or not this would actually be the best, that it was the most fun on the initial plays, but there were some concerns about will that longevity be
right,
there.
Right.
But the good news is, the way I like to play these games is not be concerned with if the longevity is going to be there and just play it. And then if the longevity isn't there, then you'll find out, you know?
Yeah.
So I just, right now I am definitely in my happy period with New Zealand. So I'm like with you. All three of them are so fun. It's like, of course, on a podcast where you're forced to like rank things,
right.
You know, this is what happens. And then as you start to rank, it almost sounds like you were just like, one is like just garbage and one is excellent, but they're all so fun.
All right. I have to hear how you guys are going to defend Sky Mines as being anything other than a disappointment. Go ahead.
You don't like Sky Mines?
You feel it was,
I don't.
Did you like Mombasa?
Yes.
What changed that you don't like?
Graphic design is terrible. Let's be honest.
Graphic design is
we can get that out of the way.
Bull.
Yeah.
Okay. Horrible.
But other than that,
here's the interesting thing. I realized that I didn't playing Sky Mines. I realized I didn't like Mombasa as much as I thought I did.
Oh, okay.
Interestingly,
It's not because you can't do an accent.
I can do a lot of accents with that. I mean, it's the moon. It is my guess is that it's a United Nations kind of zone where there are people from all over the world.
Yeah, you can do any accent you want.
I could do any accent I want for there.
It's wild card.
So you
absolutely playing, and playing let me be clear.
Dislike Mombasa.
The game where I cannot do an accent is Mombasa.
Yeah.
That is the game that I can't do an accent.
That's the game that we keep telling you, please stop, Tom. Please.
I will say that Elder loves my accent in Mombasa. but I won't do it.
Yes, well, and we appreciate that. But it's interesting that you say that though, about like that you realize in retrospect that you didn't really like Mombasa that much.
I didn't love it. It's like it was. Listen, it's a very interesting design. Mm-hmm. You're investing in shares in these various companies, and you are doing things on the board that are making them succeed more or fail more, and mm-hmm. You can change. It's very much a stock market game in a lot of very interesting ways. I like the idea of the design of it more than I like the actual implementation when it came right down to it for me.
Right.
That's fair.
So Mombasa was always a game that I felt like I admired more than I liked. I would play it. I think it's almost like my reaction was like what you just described. It's like I saw what was going on, a lot of interesting things, but I never felt that way that a lot of reviewers felt, a lot of the community felt like this game is amazing. And I just was like, it just feels like it feels like it's squirming in my arms, trying to get out of my arms, and I can't embrace it the way I want to. And with Sky Mines, but I liked it enough that I got Sky Mines. And then we played Sky Mines. I talked about this before. Like I'd played it with Candace and Mike Nikolov, and then like something changed. I don't know if it's because we played the backside of the map, because we didn't play the actual moon map, which is just a mirror of
the backside of the map is the asteroid map, right?
Right.
I do think that is the more interesting design space for sure. I've only played it once that way, and I did like it better.
Mm-hmm. I need to I need to play the classic board on Sky Mines to see if it really it comes down to that board. But
I still like the classic board. I mean,
yeah, I feel like it can't make that much of a difference. But like, whoa, we played a game, Jordan, with you, me, Matt, and Paul.
Yeah.
And I felt like every single turn I was on the edge of my seat. I was like, oh, my God, this game. I finally get it. I finally get why people love this game. It is like thrilling for me. Graphic design. Terrible in the second edition.
Terrible.
Terrible. Hate it. Hate the way it looks. It's not functional. It's not inviting or immersive.
It is, however, very white.
It's very, very, very like cotton. It's like a, it's like one of those, it's like a, it's like cotton candy.
It's gray.
It's like a cotton candy gray, like a gray cotton candy. It's
just gray.
Love it.
But the system where you're managing three discard piles is wonderful.
It's good.
The interaction on the board,
yep.
You know, taking other people's companies' pieces off and putting yours on and then manipulating the share tracks is great. And another piece of that game that's wonderful is the asymmetric corporations, right? They each have their own little
that's
power
such a
that
great
you get for
thing.
Going high up enough on the track and the, their own scoring. It's great.
It's so good. And it's a game that really, like, on your turn, it's so tense because there's always like four different things that you absolutely need to do and you don't want to relinquish that to your opponent and you have to decide what's my Sophie's choice this time.
It is a game that really suffers, I will say, from an imbalance in people who know what they're doing. If you play with four people that know what they're doing, I think you can have a great game of it. If you have a game in which two people know what they're doing and two people don't, the game really relies, like we were talking earlier about the bash the leader and, you know, you have to keep other people in check. You will see people see, oh, that corporation is doing really well. I should invest in that corporation. All you're doing is feeding the people that are already invested more heavily in that corporation, right? Mm-hmm. You need to be able to hurt that corporation and build up another one. You need to be able to play that game, and that is not something that is something that takes several players to be able to do
right.
To some extent.
And where it gets tricky is that in Sky Mines, a lot of times the way, like, one of the reasons why you're expanding your corporations in the way that you are is because you're trying to like get bonuses from the board, and so you're like, I need that bonus so badly, but then I need to expand this corporation I'm invested in, but then I also need to beat back that corporation because everyone's investing that highly. So there's so many decisions. I think it's like, that's actually probably the one that, like, Boon Lake had probably the biggest turnaround. Argentina was the biggest surprise, but Sky Mines is the one that had like rose up the highest in my estimation. It might be my number two Fister. I don't know. I really love Maracaibo also, but
what's your number one?
Great Western Trail.
The original or New Zealander?
I would have to say the system. I would have to say the original just because I played it so much. And like, I need more New Zealand plays before I can say.
I don't like Maracaibo either. So maybe there's a.
I like Maracaibo.
I love Maracaibo.
You can end the round in Maracaibo.
I like that too. I love games where you control the tempo.
Yeah.
I think that is a huge thing. I think it is hard to implement well because people don't always take advantage of it the way they should. But much like with Ra, properly played, Maracaibo is a game about greed, right?
Yeah, 100%, which is great.
Yeah. The only thing is that I'm the one, I love going on my Sunday walk through those boards. Like, I love hitting every single place.
That's right.
I just love it because it's so fun.
So
you're
a mark. You're a sucker in that game because that is not the
one. I know it's not. Yeah. Well, because that's what's tough about playing with Game Brain is because you guys are like, tempo, tempo, tempo. And you guys, like rush to Kansas City. You rush to Maracaibo. And like, I get it. That is the game. As a testament to the game, every single action space brings me so much joy. I want to stop and visit each one and play with each spot and maximize it and just have fun with it. And you can't.
It's the same as building a deck in a competitive card game, right? You always build the minimum size deck because your 51st card is your worst card. Right.
Ben wants to play Maracaibo like it's Let's Go to Japan.
I do.
That's what he wants to do.
I want to stop everywhere. I want to make a big, beautiful engine. I'm happy to take my time. And right. I feel like, didn't we play a game recently where I've said this before, my little spiel about wanting to take my time. And didn't we play a game recently where I was like, what I liked about this game was that no one could rush it and I could just enjoy my build. Don't know what it was. I mean, Terraforming Mars is, that's why Terraforming Mars is so good for me, because you can just build and build and build and build your engine. It's just nothing but engine building for hours.
That's why I do not like Terraforming Mars.
Yeah, you can't rush the end on that one.
I would say that that is not the way I play Terraforming Mars. And
oh yeah, I build.
I want to play Terraforming Mars with you right now, and I want to make you cry.
I would love. I mean, I haven't played Terraforming Mars in years. It's like as soon as I got my big, beautiful Terraforming Mars big box, because I played it so much, I got the big box. As soon as I got that, I've not played a game in like 3 years.
I hate the little dioramas in it. I don't like the art of it.
I wouldn't know.
Oh really? I think everyone. It's widely agreed. Terraforming Mars is a beautiful board game.
Because it feels like a planet. Yeah. It's immersive.
No, I'm joking.
I'm gonna go the other way on that. A little bit.
Yeah, I probably did not need to get that big box, but I went there. Anyway, that was it. That was all. Those were the big.
I think I'm going to give you an opportunity to mention one more game, Ben, because you were talking to me about City of the Big Shoulders.
Oh yeah. Well, City of the Big Shoulders is not really like a second wind for me. I mean, it is a second wind in that it's like. It's not like I disliked it. I always loved it. And then I got into 18XX and I never really went back to City of the Big Shoulders. And then this week I've been playing it on BGA and I'm like, I love this game. This game is so fun. And it's like,
is that right? Because I went the other way with it. I was like, loved it at first. And then repeated plays, I was like, oh, it's kind of like, why would I play this when there's 18XX? Because 18XX is a clearly richer, design.
But what I found, I think that's maybe why I stayed away from it, but I found playing it right now, there's like really fun, just really fun decisions to be made about how you're doing your worker placement and taking these actions and like how, you know, when you take your, when you place your meeple, you're going to be giving other people benefits and you're benefiting yourself and how you're going to use that to advance your stock price. So it's basically like an extremely operational 18XX where it's not so much about the stock manipulations. It would have been great if the game had gotten some support that maybe it could have its own version of like its own City of the Big Shoulders, Argentina and New Zealand, where there was a more financial version that did lean even more heavily into 18XX stuff. And it'd be great.
I mean, but that was the thing about City of the Big Shoulders. It's like half of 18XX. And it doesn't really add that extra element. Like there's like one or two more things in that game to make it a more economic a battle. But
there could
game.
Be more financial shenanigans. Yeah, would be great.
It could be a splatter-ish game very easily, but it doesn't quite get there.
It's one I want to revisit though. Give it another try.
It's still very fun. The decisions are really fun, and like honestly, it does bring together HNXX and Arkwright and. Like, that's kind of...
I can own the Cracker Jack company. That's all I need to know.
That's what I own right now. I'm running the Cracker Jack company, and someone just got into wheat, and I'm very upset. So we're going to see what happens. So
Well, should we wrap this one up,
Let's
guys?
Let's wrap it up.
So now is generally the time where I say that we have a thriving Discord and a thriving Facebook page where we get a lot of people talking. But actually, I have to congratulate Ben for bringing our YouTube into modern era. Ben is launching a one-man campaign to bring us into the video era, and he is kind of crushing it.
I'm just trying to get us some more followers. I'm like, we need more followers. So basically, I'm now posting the episodes on YouTube in addition to on our podcast feed, so that way people on BGG can see that we're actually podcasting out here.
Super appreciate it. You're doing great.
Thank you.
Absolutely love it.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you.
Way to go. And you've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Matthew Robinson, Ben Mandelker, Trey Alsop, and Tom Donnelly. Special thanks to Daedalus for our incredible music. You may know him as Alfred. And Edamar Peleg for our incredible graphics. You can find us on Discord, on Instagram, and on Facebook. Please come and find us. And go out today and play some games with friends. Or make some friends with games.